I pray for John as he speaks to us now. I pray for the experiences and the words and the thoughts and the prayers and the emotions that have led him to this place. And I pray for his words, but I pray for words that we hear above and beyond the actual words that John speaks. Thank you for the time that you have spent with him preparing for this. And I pray that we will listen and hear. Amen.
Right. Hello. My name is John Arthur. And for those that have known me most of my life, that doesn't come as a shock. And for those of you who have never seen me before in your life, my name is John Arthur. I'm going to be speaking to you this morning. I thought I would just take a moment. Am I sounding okay? Does the mic sound okay? I went to a church the other day and I did my very best, and then people said, oh, couldn't hear a word. It's like, okay, that's not down to me. That's down to the microphone. Ably assisted by Steve at the back, I'm going to talk to you about something that's going to come up on the screen beautifully as we speak. Before that does, in the frankly minutes of research that I did to get ready for my talk this morning, I rediscovered something that I think I kind of already knew. I think most of us kind of already know this, which is that monks are really good brewers. They brew like crazy. They brew beer and they brew wine and they brew all sorts of other stuff. And as I was researching the history of this, what the monks did was it was a subsistence deal. They had to, you know, make enough money to run the monastery, and so they would brew beer and they would sell it, and what they kept they would run the monastery with, and what they had left they would give to the poor. All very good. Now, because they were monks, they needed to do whatever they did the very best that they could do. And so they started to brew what was the very best beer. But I never quite got to the bottom, and I'm not sure any historian ever has, as to why they had to brew the very strongest beer. That seems to be taking things a little bit too far. So all of these great beers that the Trappists and the Benedictines and the various other people brew are all like, you know, proper heavy-duty alcohol that you end up getting out of these folk. And I think they're in Switzerland or France somewhere, let's say France, people who make Buckfast, right? Buckfast wine is brewed by monks, right? But it's 15, 16, 17% by volume. It's really, really heavy-duty wine. And not satisfied with making it the most alcoholic wine that they could brew, they also decided to put in a couple of espresso. So it's loaded with caffeine as well. So it's like Red Bull. It's like the night before and the Red Bull mixed together. And Buckfast is very, very famous. Not to you. You don't really recognize the name. But if you come from Ireland or if you come from Scotland, where there's a thing called the Buckfast Triangle, and this is not a good thing. In Ayrshire, this kind of fortified wine is all part of the culture, and maybe part of the negative side of culture. And these monks, thinking they were glorifying God, maybe weren't doing that after all. Another part of my research was that, as well as brewing really strong alcohol, monks are famous for chants. They're famous for writing chants. Now, you know what happens when two thoughts in your head go away and they have a baby and they don't tell you, and then they come back and show you the baby? I'm just imagining. You've got to imagine Selkirk Abbey, circa 1300 and something oatcake, right? Selkirk Abbey, and the sun's going down, and the rooks are going off to the rook. Oh, God, and they're going off, and it's all very beautiful, and birds are tweeting and stuff. And then you hear the sound of heavy horses. You look in the distance, and up comes this big car full of these rotund gentlemen, you know, in their Hessian gear. And they all kind of get out. It's like a football coach arriving, you know. They all kind of get out, and they're all going in, and they're all greeting the people of the opposite team who are wearing different colours, of course, because and they all go in and they say, "Well, why don't we quaff a few ales whilst we're here?" So cheers, and on we go, and they're all sort of drinking and eating and stuff. And I figure that once they've had enough drinking and eating, and once it's got a little bit more leery, that's when the chanting starts. That's what would happen in Scotland. And you could just imagine them. So it's all getting a bit rowdy and a bit bawdy, and somebody goes, "No kidding, he's massive. He gives me lots of blessings. Son of God, son of God." And the people on the other side go, oh, really? He's cosmic. He's the most. He is the Lord of hosts. Holy Ghost, Holy Ghost." And it all gets really bawdy, you know, and they're all throwing things at each other, and it all kind of rattles on until the clock winds down and it all goes. And then there's a female boot at the door. Because the mother superior in the convent up the way has come down to find out what all the noise is about. And so she's there with her nuns. Ave Maria, grazia plenty. She's here. She's scary. She is the Virgin Mary, Mother of God, Mother of God. And I could just see this turning into that, like Leonardo and Kate in at the end of Titanic, and all the poor people are all playing the violins, and everybody's dancing. They're all slightly doomed. Oh, there you go. Now, unfortunately, that's not the chance. I think the church would be a very different place if that's what had happened. That's not the chance that the monks were given to ridden. Right, because chant is a word for, it's a French word, and it means song, or Latin cantor. And one of the songs, here it is, that we tend to view through the twinkly lights of the Christmas tree is this O Come, O Come Emmanuel thing. And it's a funny deal because we only sing it at one time of year. And yet, I think it's an amazing hymn that should be sung almost all the time. It's also, for those of you who know me, one of my favorites. It's a very complex song because it operates on at least three levels. The first level is theological. It operates at a theological level. Because like all songs of that year, I mean, this is I researched this and it's a 12th, 13th century song. And the stuff that you could find out about where this song came from is really, really very, very, very boring. So I'm not going to tell it to you. I'm not going to tell it to you. But if you've got the mind that wants to look at these things, this has been around a long time. And it's theologically very deep. You see, and it's one of those songs that you can almost sing from heart. And if you want to know what theology's got into a person, look at what they sing from the heart. Don't look at what they sing when they're led, because those are different. And it's riddled with theological truth, like a lot of the songs from that period and then the later periods was. But it also contains this kind of timeless eschatology, because it has this complex form where it's talking about the past, it's talking about the now, and it's talking about the future, and it's doing it simultaneously. And you're supposed to kind of philosophically hold those ideas in tension in your head. And the other thing about it is it's a song of deep soul. It's just powerful. It just works, and you don't know why, but it just works, and it speaks to a part of you that you can't really fully describe. And it has those kind of features, which is one of the reasons I like it. I've got two fantasies about this song. One is I would like it to be sung at my funeral. So you heard it here first. If I get there before you, let's have this. And the other fantasy I have is that I've always desired to sing this song in a church, but solo. Now, those of you who know me might realize there's a teeny tiny problem with that prospectus, which is I'm not exactly famous for my singing voice. Nonetheless, that is what I am going to do. Because every now and then it should be the preacher who's terrified, not the people. I'm going to do something very, very simple with you. I'm going to take you through this. And we are going to talk about it one to another. Now, you've got a role. I don't want you you've got the refrain. You know what the refrain is? Rejoice, rejoice. I don't want you to do it at the end of the verse. I want you to do it at a point when I indicate that I would like you to do it. So we're going to preach this sermon together. And it's an Advent sermon. It's a welcoming sermon. It's only five verses, so if it's horrible, you're nearly there. Right. O come, O come, Emmanuel, and ransom captive Israel, that mourns in lonely exile here, until the Son of God appear. Rejoice, but you can't rejoice, because you don't know what you're rejoicing. Who is this Emmanuel person? And why do we want him to come? Well, we know, those of us who are in the know that this is Jesus, and that when the angel visits Mary and when it's all getting wound up, that she's told he's to be called Emmanuel, which is kind of odd because she calls him Joshua. But anyway, whatever. But he's given a title. And the title is a very, very old title. And the title means that God is with us. So this mourning, this desire for God to be with us, why is God being with us? Well, because he's coming with us to pay a ransom. Now, you don't pay a ransom for something that you're trying to buy. A ransom has a meaning. A ransom has a value. A ransom is paid when someone has been kidnapped. The ransom is set by the offending party. And it must be tantamount to the value of the life that will be released. It can be no less. You can't pay in installments. You don't want them back in bits. It is the value of the life that has been taken that must be paid if that life is to be returned. And that's what this song wants. It wants this person to come and ransom somebody. And the person who's to be ransomed has been taken captive. And his name or her name or their name is Israel. Why are Israel captive? Who's holding them to ransom? And they mourn in their exile. And this song speaks to this idea that there is something wrong. There is something that has been done. There is something that puts us in exile. We are not in the place where we need to be. We are not in the place where we want to be. And we cannot affect our getting there. Somebody has to ransom us. Who is that going to be? It's going to be this mysterious Emmanuel figure. And we transform the idea of Emmanuel into the Son of God who's going to appear, which all Christians know who that is. We know it's Jesus. Now, the original concept would have been a figure called the Son of Man. And you find him in the book of Daniel. Now, the book of Daniel is a hugely theologically important book to the Jews because it tells of many things, but one of the things it says in chapter 7, verse 9 is this. As I looked, thrones were set in place, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was as white as snow. The hair of his head was like wool. His throne was flaming with fire, and its wheels were ablaze. A river of fire was flowing and coming out before him, and thousands upon thousands attended him. 10,000, 10 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated, and the books were opened. This is heavy stuff. Verse 13, in my vision at night I looked, and there before me was one like a Son of Man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days, and he was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All nations and all peoples of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. Now this is the gospel, people. This is our song. And we are the ones who must sing it. So can I invite you to make the refrain? Rejoice, rejoice, Emmanuel shall come to thee, O Israel. Who's Israel? We are. Let's look at the next verse. O come, thou rod of Jesse free, thine own from Satan's tyranny. From depths of hell thy people save, and give them victory o'er the grave. What's a rod? The rod of Jesse, what's that? Well, it's relatively simple, actually. The rod is a part of the shepherd's staff. We know that... where do the rod and staff turn up? Interact with me. There's a famous place in the Bible where thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. That's Psalm 23, Psalm 23. Okay, good. Who roughly speaking wrote Psalm 23? David. What was his occupation before he became a king? He was a shepherd, right? So, this is good. Anybody know his father's name? Jesse, well done. So, this is who Jesse is. And the rod of Jesse, so the rod was the top bit, I understand, of the shepherd's staff. And the staff is the bit that you walk with. So the staff makes you able to walk, but the rod is the bit that you use to pull the sheep out of the ditch, so you don't have to go in the ditch yourself. But you also use it to fight the wolf and sweep its legs and do all sorts of stuff with it. So this rod of Jesse is going to come and it's going to set us free, and it's going to set us free from Satan's tyranny. Well, who's this? Who is this Satan person that has turned up? And why does he have a tyranny? You don't need me to answer that question because you've got the BBC News. You know what's happening in Syria. You know what's happening on the Ivory Coast. You know what's happening in all these bits. You know that this bit, our world, is not what it's like for most other people. We live in the special bit. We live in the blessed bit. But people will tell you all day, every day about Satan's tyranny elsewhere. And we know in some way the tyranny of the oppression of our own lives as they become as difficult as they need to be, because something is going on. Something is oppressing us. From depths of hell, people say, the original concept of hell was a Hebrew concept. It was Sheol. It was the grave. It was the shadow. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. It was a shadow that hung over any real life. And it made that life frightened, for its ultimate peril would be that it would be distanced from what it meant. It would need to be ransomed from where it had gone. And give them victory over the grave. That's a bit ostentatious. How's that going to happen? How are we going to be victorious over something that comes to us all? I mean, something supernatural, something special would have to happen for that to be there. And that's where Jesse comes into his own, because, unsurprisingly, the hymn writer had something very much else in mind than just Jesse, who's Ruth's grandson. Ruth and Boaz had Obed, and Obed had Jesse, and Jesse had David, and the line of Jesse is the line of Jesus. Isaiah 11:5, a shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse. This is the idea of the kingdom cut down. The tree's gone. It's finished. It's not a glorious cedar of Lebanon. It's not some massive oak of God. It's a stump in the ground. It's gone. All the glory's gone. The Davidic kingdom is over. Israel was finished. They split up. They ruined themselves. The kings were terrible. The prophets tried to save them. It didn't work. It all went to hell in the handbasket. They were exiled in Assyria. They were exiled in Babylon. Everything went to hell. And yet, one wee guy called Isaiah said, "Don't worry. A shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse. From his root, a branch will bear fruit. The Spirit of the Lord will rest upon him." Oh, it's a hymn now. The Spirit of the Lord will rest upon him. The Spirit of wisdom and of understanding, the Spirit of counsel and of might, the Spirit of the knowledge of the fear of the Lord. And he will delight in the fear of the Lord. He will not judge by what he sees with his eyes or decide by what he hears with his ears. But with righteousness he will judge the needy, and with justice give decisions to whom? To the poor of the earth. From verse 10, in that day the root of Jesse will stand as a banner for the peoples. The nations will rally to him, and his resting place will be glorious. In that day the Lord will reach out his hand a second time to reclaim the surviving remnant of his people from Assyria, from Lower Egypt, from Upper Egypt, from Cush, from Elam, from Babylonia, from Hamath, and from the islands of the Mediterranean. He will raise up a banner for the nations. And we are they. We write joy all over the building at this point because we are that banner. That is who we are. This is the gospel. This is our song. We have to sing it. Let me invite you to refrain. Can I have the day spring up? Oh, come thou day spring, come and cheer our spirits by thine advent here. Disperse the gloomy clouds of night, and death's dark shadows put to flight. Rejoice, but you don't know what you're rejoicing for yet, do you? Dayspring is an 18th century word that just means dawn. It's not anything more fantastic than that. But it also conveys, as we do, and those of us, and I'm not getting political here, those of us who feel we're on the dawn of a new era because the government is settled, well done. Those of us who feel we're on the dawn of a terrible era, but we use this idea, dawn of a new era. And that's what this is requesting. It's requesting that a new era dawns, something good comes. And it will come and it will cheer. And the cheers is a bit like goodbye. I said to someone the other day, and they were flabbergasted. I said, you know, goodbye is just a Christian blessing. And they said, no, it's not. I said, yes, it is. It means God be with you. Like adieu in French and adios in Spanish and loads of other languages that I don't know the word for goodbye in. But a lot of them convey this idea that you go to God. That's what it is. So the cheer that's there is a deeper thing. It's the source of happiness. It's not happiness itself. It's the thing within us that makes us compelled to be happy. It is a cheering and in living. So we want a day spring that brings this cheer. And the cheer has to occur in our spirits, and it occurs in our spirits because of this advent, the root of adventure, that something is occurring. And because that occurs, we will be cheered. Because it will disperse the gloomy clouds of night. And night is something that is very important in biblical language. Jesus says, look, there are 12 hours of daylight. As long as they're there, you can walk in the light, but the darkness is coming. John says, the world is dark, but Jesus is the light of the world, and that darkness will not overcome him. These have heavy rhetorical meanings in our understanding. And there it is again. Death is going to be put to flight. How is this possible? How will death be put to flight? Death ends us all. How will it be put to flight? And yet the morning of this song is that's what will happen. Who is this dayspring? King David, the one about whom, one around whom so much of this is hanging, died in his old age, which was good for him. And as you would with all kings, somebody was there with a pen, ready to write down the last things that he said. So we've got the last words of David here. 2 Samuel 23. The Spirit of the Lord spoke through me. His word was on my tongue. The God of Israel spoke. The Rock of Israel said to me, when one rules over people in righteousness, when he rules in the fear of God, he is like the light of the morning at sunrise. On a cloudless morning, he's the brightness after rain that brings the grass and the earth. The dayspring is intended to come. This is the gospel. This is our song. We have to sing it. Can I have the key of David? Oh, come thou key of David, come and open wide our heavenly home. Make safe the way that leads on high and close the path to misery. Rejoice, but you can't rejoice until you know what you're rejoicing for. Oh, come thou key of David, come. David is central to this song. David is central to the psyche of Christians. David is central to the Christmas story. David is central to so many things. And it's that then, that now, and that not yet that you see in this notion of the key of David, being there. Again, not getting political, but When a certain bunch of people on this island sing, oh, flower of Scotland, when will we see your likes again? That flower of Scotland has a name. He is the key of Wallace. And they sing about the then, the now, and the not yet. This is a human propensity to build songs that hold eschatological tension, that hold the idea of who is our destiny and how will we get there and who but ourselves will we rouse in order that that's going to happen. And open wide our heavenly home. This is the first time we get a mention of some other notion here than just this earth and just this world and just this death. There's a heavenly home that we can go to. Make safe the way. Now, if it was me, I would have capitalized that W. Because we have someone we know who is called the Way. Do we know who that is? Jesus. I am the Way. Jesus never said, I am the answer. Jesus said, I am the Way. I am the Way. Make safe, vouchsafe the way that leads on high. The constant notion of the human condition that there is a higher version of us. There is a higher place. There is something better in us that ought to be coming out, but it isn't coming out, and we don't know why, and we want it to stop. There is something higher, and it is a thing that will close out at last the existential angst of being human, the path of misery. I don't know where your misery is this morning. I don't know if it's in your health, in your wealth, in your marriage, in your relationships, in your satisfaction with who you are or where you got to, or in your difficulties with mental health. I just know that misery is common to us all. And we want that path closed. We want that gone. We need that not to be there. We are anticipating an Eden. We're anticipating a voice of God waiting for us that is a voice that is intimacy, a voice that is health, a voice that is shalom, a voice that is wonderment at how beautiful, how perfect, how good it is that God has made us. And we can't even find it. And it's driving us crazy. So we write poetry. And we demand that somebody must come. Some other, someone outside must come. Surely someone can come and save us from this. Isaiah again, in his more threatening voice, says to the incumbent on the throne, who is disproportionately evil and who is not the right one to lead the people, who's not the one that God intended, who is not following the way of righteousness, says, beware you. The Lord is about to take a firm hold of you and hurl you away, you mighty man. He'll roll you up tightly like a ball. He'll throw you into a large country and there you'll die. And the other chariots that you were so proud of will become a disgrace to your master's house. I will depose you from your office and you will be ousted from your position. In that day I will summon my servant Eliakim, son of Hilkiah. I will clothe him in your robe. I will fasten his sash around him, your sash around him, and hand your authority over to him. He will be the father of those who live in Jerusalem and to the people of Judah, and I will place on his shoulder the key to the house of David. What he opens, no one can shut, and what he shuts, no one can open. When John was writing the Revelation, he wanted to tell us how that prophecy had come true. And so he said to us, there is one. There is one. I have found one. I have seen one. My eyes have seen. My hands have touched. I know there is one. To the angel of the church at Philadelphia write, these are the words of him who is holy and true, who holds the key of David. What he opens, no one can shut, and what he shuts, no one can open. I know your deeds. See, I have placed before you an open door that no one can shut. I know that you have little strength, yet you have kept my word and have not denied my name. How do you close the path to misery? You just hold on to your hope. You realize that the door that's been opened before you will never be shut by anybody again. The ransom has been paid. The exile is over. The captivity is finished. The one who said he was going to do it has come for you. Just hold fast. Misery is temporary. There is a way. And we are the custodians of that way. This is the gospel. This is our song. We have to sing it. Can I get the Lord of Might up this time? In the version I've got, this is where this bit turns up. In the version that you've got, it's earlier. I'd put it earlier, actually. It's more appropriate earlier. I see the Lord of Might. O come, thou Lord of Might, who to thy tribes on Sinai's height, in ancient times didst give the law, in cloud and majesty and awe. Rejoice, but you can't rejoice until you know what you're rejoicing for. Who is this Lord of Might? Well, all Christians know that is the name of God. That is God. Who are these tribes? That's the 12 tribes of Israel, and we are the spiritual inheritors of their destiny, so it's us. Where is the Sinai? Well, this is the mountain that where Moses met God, and where God says, I'll send you out, you'll do what you're going to do, come back here, I'll meet you back here, we'll have another conversation. So when they come back to have another conversation, God says, here are some laws. Here are 10 commandments. Give these to the people that will hold them fast. Sinai is the place where the silence that was caused by Eden is finally broken. God speaks and Adam and Eve can answer. Until then it was impossible. It was not possible. And God said, take these strictures, hold this, and it will keep you close enough to me that we can speak to each other. I will give you the law, and I will give you it in such a frightening way, in such a way as you understand who the hell it is you are dealing with here, that you will never question me again. I'm going to be the most powerful, frightening, imaginable thing. So you know who you're supposed to be afraid of. And then you better fear, because that's going to be the way that keeps you good. Because otherwise I see no hope in this situation. But it's not the last verse, is it? It's not the last verse. The writer of Hebrews, whoever he or she was, knew this story, knew it deeply, and wanted to say something that had happened. The key of David had come. The ransom had been paid. The captivity did get cancelled. The Lord of Might did appear, but he didn't appear as he had before. You have not come to a mountain that can be touched and that is burning with fire, to darkness and gloom and storm, and to a trumpet blast, or to a voice, such a voice speaking the words that those who heard it begged that no further word be spoken to them, because they could not bear what was commanded. If even an animal touches the mountain, it must be stoned to death. The sight was so terrifying that Moses, for goodness sake, said, I am trembling with fear. That's not what you've come to. You have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem. You have come to thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly, to the church of the firstborn whose names are written in heaven. You have come to God, the judge of all, to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that was his blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel, which sums up in all its misery, in all its hatred, in all its death, in all its awfulness, the human condition. I'm reversing that, says God. And I'm doing it through Jesus, by his advent here. And when you see the beginning from the end of that, you will have cause to rejoice. This is our gospel. This is our song. We have to sing it. Emmanuel did come. Emmanuel has come to you this morning and will keep coming to you whenever you need him. And Emmanuel will come. This is the catastrophic hope of Christians. It is not going to stay like this. This is our gospel. This is our song. Accept no substitutes. We are the ones who have to sing it. Amen.